Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm the director of the Global Strategy Institute here at CSIS. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this Seven Revolutions Forum. I'd like to begin with two housekeeping details, the first of which is a plea for you to turn off whatever noise-emitting devices that you have. And the second is to remind you that today's proceedings are on record. We are being taped, as you can see, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. Within CSIS, the Global Strategy Institute is dedicated to looking at longer-range trends. We have the opportunity to look at everything from demographics to resource constraints. We have a large project on water to a range of other issues, not least of which is looking at a whole constellation of issues involving human health. Not long ago, I had the opportunity to meet and talk with the board of directors of the American Cancer Society, and I began reading about the challenge of chronic disease, and as I learned more and more about this, the more apparent it became to me that it was a tremendously compelling issue that we need to address more, both from the standpoint of research and also from the standpoint of policy. So I'm doubly grateful to our participants, our outstanding speakers here today, that we could focus this session of the Seven Revolutions Forum on where chronic disease is, where it's going, and the complex of interesting issues associated with it. Let's face it, I think the materials that you have in your packet make this clear, that the whole issue of chronic disease is an enormous challenge. The fact is that chronic diseases are the largest cause of death in the world. The dimensions are not well understood. I know that we'll probably be talking about that this morning. We need to think about chronic disease in relation to infectious or non-communicable diseases, which from time to time have a significantly more urgent nature. Then there's the whole issue of perception. Is chronic disease a disease of the elderly? How do we begin to tease this out? My guess is, and no doubt our speakers will address themselves to this, that sometimes the realities differ significantly with the perceptions. Now, beyond that, the problem of chronic disease is big and getting bigger. The projections are off the charts. And the scope of the problem is also shifting quickly to include a developing world in ways that are counterintuitive to many of us. Now, the final point that I'd like to make here in a preliminary way is that, at least on the basis of our early discussions and reading, the conclusion is inescapable that the policy response is not commensurate with the seriousness or severity of the challenge that we face. And I hope perhaps we can test that proposition with our experts here today. I regard today's discussion as what I hope will be the first of several that we will assign to the challenge of chronic disease. And I hope that you'll be active in terms of your discussion today and also the feedback that you give us after today's event so that we can put together future events that will contribute to moving forward our understanding of this critical challenge. So with that, now it's my pleasure to provide an abbreviated introduction of our two speakers. And I will introduce them in the order that they will be speaking. Rachel, you'll be going first, sure. Right? Dr. Rachel Nugent is Director of Health and Economics of the Population Reference Bureau. She is Project Director of BRIDGE, that is Bringing Information into Decision-Making for Global Effectiveness, a USAID-funded project of policy communication. She heads a team of professionals involved in communication and dissemination of population-related information to policymakers, media, and researchers in developing countries. She also directs the Hewlett PRB Research Program in Population and Economic Development. She was formerly Program Director of Health and Economics Programs at the Fogarty International Center of NIH, where she developed and managed research and training programs related to health and economic development. She, among her research topics are cost-effective interventions on chronic disease in developing countries and nutrition and agricultural policies in developing countries as well. Dr. Soji Adeyi is the coordinator of public health programs at the World Bank. He's also an adjunct assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He has extensive experience in policy strategies and programs for health systems and disease control at the global, regional, and country levels. He led the malaria task force that produced the World Bank Global Strategy and Booster Program for Malaria Control, and he's also team leader for the work program on public policy and the control of non-communicable diseases. Apparently, there is a report on the horizon, important report from the World Bank, and we'll be lucky to hear from him on that. He also has extensive qualifications, the totality of which are in the document in front of you. So with that, by way of short preliminary comments and introduction, I'd like to thank once again these two outstanding speakers for being with us today. And Rachel, I'd like to turn things to you, please.
Thank you, Eric. And I'm very happy to be here. Can you hear me? This is a very interesting topic that I have a tendency to get passionate about, even at 9 in the morning. So I have a few notes here. I want to give you a few numbers. I have the advantage of going first, so I'm going to describe the situation with chronic diseases, focusing primarily on developing countries, because that's been my focus, and that's where a lot of the action is, or inaction if you're looking at the policy level. And I'll mention a few items here, give you a bit of scope, talk about cost-effectiveness of interventions, which is one of the areas that I've concentrated on. And I hope that gives you a sense of what's going on. And then I hope it doesn't step too much on what Soji wants to say as well, and we'll have a discussion. I do want to congratulate CSIS for its perceptivity in noticing and looking at this issue. When I started working on it only 5 years ago, it was really under the radar screen for everybody but a few public health geeks at WHO, for the most part. And I worked on the development of the global strategy with WHO, the global strategy on diet, nutrition, and prevention of chronic diseases. That might not be the exact name because it changed over time, and I always forget the exact name. And it looked, it became a political hot potato. And it looked like that might just be one of those things that goes on a shelf and becomes one of those ideas whose time has not yet come. And that hasn't happened. There are several reasons why the issue has, I think, grown in people's awareness. And one of those reasons is that there has been what I would consider a quite sudden and very serious surge in health problems caused by specific risk factors, chronic health problems caused by specific risk factors that we'll talk about. There also have been a few very vocal experts who have kept the issue in front of people internationally. Of course, domestically, it's in the newspapers almost every day, it seems, here. But it's been kept in front of some people internationally by some experts, including my co-author on the Disease Control Priorities Project, Walter Willett, who's written a lot about this. And it's been kept on the agenda because of careful, smart people like those at CSIS who notice long-term trends and who look at trends and say this is something important. So in my first few minutes here, I'd like to summarize a few key points. I'm going to do it as I was first trained as a journalist, the way a journalist writes a lead, which is the who, what, when, where, and why of the issue. And I'll just put out a couple of statistics in those areas for our lead. I'd like to also acknowledge my co-author, Mark Cirka from WHO, who has been my collaborator recently on work on this issue, and another collaborator, Tom Gazziano from Harvard, who has been my collaborator in the past on prior work on cost effectiveness. So they're largely responsible for some of the best ideas there. So the who. As Eric referred to, it's easy to have the wrong impression of this problem. It actually exists in rich and poor countries. And very often when I talk to people about this, when it comes up in cocktail conversation, people assume that it exists only in the rich countries. That's not true. It exists among rich and poor people within those countries. You know, you have to look within a country to really understand what's going on in the health situation, because averages don't often tell you what you need to know. An average is just an average, as we know. So when you look within countries, you find that chronic diseases and the risk factors leading to them are across rich and poor people, although there it gets a little bit complex, and I'll deal a little bit with that in a moment. Depends on the disease and the risk factor that you're looking at. And it exists among the young and the old. It's easy for people to see chronic diseases as only an old person's problem, you know, that's kind of what's implied by chronic diseases. You know, it takes a long time for the disease to really emerge and affect people's health. Well, that's not true either. It exists among the young and the poor. So in terms of the perceptions that Eric mentioned, it's important to understand these misperceptions to start off with. A little bit of flavor, a little bit of numbers to add to that. Chronic diseases are the majority of diseases. When the WHO divides diseases into non-communicable, communicable, including nutrition and injuries. And the chronic disease category of those three is now the largest in all countries in the world except the low-income category. I'm using World Bank country categories here. They account for the majority of deaths and DALYs. There are some people in the room who will know what DALYs are. I'm going to very, very briefly tell you what those are because it's an important difference between deaths and DALYs. DALYs are disability-adjusted life years, and it's a metric, a number that the WHO uses, and a lot of people in health now use, to encompass both the deaths and the disability, the suffering and the pain and the discomfort and all of the problems that occur in somebody when they're sick. They might not have died yet. They might not even die from the disease, but they will have some problems. So the DALY includes both of those. And when you're talking about chronic diseases, it's very important to consider the disability part because it can take a long time of having a disability before somebody dies of the disease, if they die of the disease. When we look at deaths, chronic diseases account for the majority of all deaths in all regions except sub-Saharan Africa and the majority of DALYs in all regions except sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And those exceptions are likely to change relatively soon. That is, chronic diseases will be the majority in all areas of the world relatively soon. Projections are certainly before the year 2030. Going beyond the country averages, when you look at the distribution within countries, you find this complex picture that I mentioned. Tobacco use is more common among the poor in all countries almost across the board. So that one is quite easy in a way, quite obvious, and it's actually been counted up. It's been studied more than a lot of these other chronic diseases, especially in poor countries. In a sample from WHO of poor countries, we see it's a relatively small sample of countries, but we see that the poor are more likely to have angina, a precursor to serious heart disease, than the rich, but they are less likely to be physically inactive or to have diabetes than the rich. And this, we're not at this point even allowing for the fact that the rich are more likely to be screened and diagnosed. So that makes the numbers somewhat questionable. And there's been work across countries. It's relatively recent work that suggests that when countries reach a per capita income level of about $2,500 a year, then this balance between the infectious or communicable diseases and the chronic or non-communicable diseases switches, and then the chronic diseases take the majority, that is, are more common in countries that have reached $2,500 a year per capita income. So an easy way to think about it is that, you know, when countries are poor, infectious diseases predominate. When countries are rich, chronic diseases predominate. But there's a transition going on all the time as countries are developing. So it's not one or the other, of course. Finally, on the WHO, looking at the age at which people are affected, it's clear that chronic diseases are not an old person's problem. One-third of deaths from chronic diseases in middle-income countries occur before the age of 60, and 80% of the DALYs, you remember that's the disease and disabilities, occur before the age of 60 in all country categories, country income categories. It's really spread widely across people and across countries. Then more quickly, I'll touch on the what, where, why, and when questions. The what, when I'm talking about chronic diseases, I'm talking about heart disease and stroke, cancers, chronic respiratory diseases, and diabetes primarily. A lot of those are nutrition-related diseases, and that's what I've concentrated on. And the risk factors for those, primarily the main risk factors, smoking, physical inactivity, and poor diets. So that's what I'm concentrating on. There are lots of different definitions, and you'll note that I've already used the term chronic disease and non-communicable disease. There's a bit debate about what it should be, and there's lots of things to say about that. There's no right answer, so I'm using both terms. When? The interesting thing about chronic diseases in developing countries is that it's a relatively recent phenomenon and a relatively quick phenomenon. The data are not very good, so it's hard to pinpoint when this upsurge started, but it's clear that it has happened faster than it has happened in developed countries. And the data that I'm familiar with suggests that the upsurge started in the 80s. In the countries where we have relatively good time series data, we really didn't see this happening before the 80s, whereas in the U.S., as an example, we are all very familiar with the obesity epidemic here, as it's called. It started way back in the 60s, very clearly. Where? In the developing world, we see, especially among women, more than men, we see it very strongly in many Latin American countries, and by it I mean chronic disease development and particularly sort of obesity-related chronic diseases. And we see it in the Middle East, again, among women primarily, but it also is very apparent and growing fast in India, in China, and even in parts of Africa. I was about a month ago in East Africa for a meeting of Eastern, Southern, Central African health experts, and the title of their conference, the chosen title from them, was Chronic Disease Epidemic, which really surprised me that they're seeing it as a big problem. The why, finally, there's lots of reasons. That's what CSIS is going to answer for us, I'm sure, eventually. But globalization and all of its manifestations, advertising, communication, global food supply, trade, changing dietary patterns, changing labor patterns, less manual labor, changing roles of women, all of those things can be a part of the problem, and all of them are. So there's not one answer. Now, that's the lead, and I'll just very briefly, I want to focus for a moment on cost-effectiveness and turn it over to Seiji. What is cost-effectiveness? It's a way that economists use to measure how easily we can do something about a problem. That's kind of a very non-technical way of putting it. But most of you have heard, I'm sure maybe all of you have heard about cost-benefit analysis, a way that economists use to measure the benefits and the costs of doing something, making an intervention. Cost-effectiveness analysis is sort of a step back from cost-benefit. It is difficult to measure benefits. With cost-effectiveness, we don't have to. We measure the costs, and we measure the health effects of an intervention. If you do an intervention, how much does it improve someone's health? Maybe a little, maybe a lot, maybe not at all. You look at that and you put those together and you have a cost-effectiveness measure. And it allows you to compare the bang for the buck, if you will, the relative cheapness of getting improvements in health from different types of interventions. So we need to know what bang for the buck we get if we want to address this issue. And this actually, it does require a lot of data. There are not very good data on most of this stuff, and that in itself could be the subject of a long talk, which I won't get into. But with the limited information we have, it does appear that there are cost-effective interventions in the developing world that can be used to address these problems, the chronic disease problems. Particularly at the population-wide level and community-based level, when interventions reach large populations, when they address high mortality and morbidity diseases, such as smoking, tobacco-related diseases, and when they are integrated and multi-pronged, they can be very, very cost-effective, and we do have some good examples. Now, these population-wide interventions are important in developing countries and probably, though we don't have clear evidence yet, probably more effective than the same kind of interventions in developed countries because developing countries have weak health systems where people are not likely to be able to go into their healthcare provider to get screened, to get diagnosed as much as we are. Believe it or not, those countries don't have as good preventive medicine as we do oftentimes. So these interventions can be cost-effective and are likely to become more cost-effective as those populations age and as globalization moves onward, which is certainly going to happen. So let me give you just a couple of examples of what appear to be very cost-effective interventions, and I'll stop with that. One, taxes on tobacco. Now, this was one of the This was and is one of the controversial issues. Of course, taxing anything is very controversial, but we have experience in the U.S. and elsewhere. Taxes on tobacco have been incredibly effective at reducing smoking. A recent estimate from the Disease Control Priorities Project is that a 33% price increase, which sounds like a lot, but is actually less than some tobacco taxes in this country, would reduce deaths by 5 to 15% of all deaths from smoking, which translated into a cost-effectiveness ratio, the cost per dally saved, that is, avoiding the disease and disability that a person would have from smoking, the cost would be only $13 to $195, depends on the country and where you're looking. That's pretty cheap for saving a death and or disability. Other ones I don't have... cost-effectiveness ratios on all these, but just take it from me that the evidence suggests that these would be cost-effective. Other kinds of smoking cessation programs, nicotine replacement therapy, community-based physical activity programs. We have one very good example in Brazil that we have cost-effectiveness data from. It's fairly persuasive. Population-wide education programs, including using the mass media, especially if combined with community activities such as community walks, free blood pressure screenings, and so on. We have some good examples of those, and credit must be given to the public health authorities in Finland, who were the very first to try to address this. And incidentally, the person who really launched that program in Finland a long time ago, Pekka Puska, who's head of the Institute for Public Health there, is a contender for the WHO director general position that will be decided soon. So he's an advocate of addressing non-communicable diseases. Changes in ingredients at the manufacturing level. You might have seen the story in the New York Times on Tuesday and the Science Times about trans fat. There have been a lot of efforts led in part by Walter Willett at Harvard to reduce the amount of trans fat at the manufacturing level. This can be effective depending on the diet of the country, whether there is a lot of trans fat and depending on the health risks of the country. Reducing salt as well at the manufacturing level can have a significant effect. And then lastly, this is not a preventive measure necessarily. It can be prevention. People talk about a poly pill, which doesn't really exist yet, but it's a combination of a low cholesterol lowering and blood pressure lowering, possibly with some aspirin thrown in, medicine, a combination pill that could be given prophylactically. There's no product, there's no clinical trials yet, so it's a long way off, but it is something that people are talking about a lot because it could be very cheap, of course, and it could be administered relatively easily. So that's it. That's the end of my list. And I guess turn it over to Soji.
Rachel, thank you very much. Soji, yes, thank you for joining us, and now we look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for having me. Good morning, everyone. First, I would like to acknowledge that what I'm about to share with you is the work of about 20, 25 colleagues in and outside the World Bank, and it's still a work in progress. So if I say anything that you like, credit goes to them. If I say something that elicits a boo, then it's for me alone. I think that Rachel got us off to a very strong start, so I will not repeat what she has said other than to say, I think that gives us a solid platform on which to discuss further. Now, ideally, what might we like to see collectively? We probably would like to see a situation in which, given that death is inevitable, we all live to a ripe old age, ripe old meaning whatever is acceptable in a particular society. And then perhaps at the age of 100 or 105, depending on how far you want to push it, we'll just drop dead suddenly. Okay. That really would be the ideal scenario, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, that's not the reality. So why bother? The rationale is multiple. One is that of health as a desirable thing in itself. It's just nicer to be healthy than it is to be unhealthy. It's nicer to be free of illness and disability than to have those illnesses and disabilities. Even the cell phone agrees with me.
I didn't listen to Eric's
Thanks,
instructions.
Thanks, Rachel. They're calling to say, so you just said something we don't agree with.
So sorry.
So in addition to health as a desirable thing in itself, there are several reasons why public policy ought to concern itself with the growing burden of chronic non-communicable diseases. One, it has impact on the individual and on the household. There's expenditure on treatment of chronic illnesses, and by definition, it lasts a long time. In addition to that, there's the collective effect on the economy of a country. If you just look at some of the numbers with which many of you are familiar, for example, about three-quarters or about 72% of cardiovascular diseases occur in the working age population, for example. And that says something. That a large number of otherwise productive hours of work that will be spent in the doctor's clinic or at home or somewhere in some vehicle on the way to the hospital. So these are losses to the economy. In addition to that, demographic projections suggest very strongly that low-income countries and middle-income countries are on a trajectory that will result in higher burdens of these non-communicable diseases in the future. Recently, there was a publication from the East Asia region looking at specifically at risk factors for cardiovascular diseases and then zeroing in on hypertension. And what they found was that while hypertension accounted for some 30 to 50% of the variation that you find in the incidence of cardiovascular diseases, in fact, age was the most significant among those. So I hate to break it to all of us in this room, but age really is going to contribute to our ill health in the future. Okay. Now, what does that mean? How much of this entire burden can be prevented? We can look at projections, with the caveat, of course, that projections are not predictions. And what does the evidence show? Let's take a step back and look at the experiences of the high income countries and the middle income countries, with some emphasis on the high income countries of North America and Western Europe, for example. In fact, there's reason to believe that a lot of the progress that they have made in reducing illnesses and disabilities from non-communicable diseases comes not exclusively from prevention alone, but from a combination of prevention and effective clinical interventions. And here, for the sake of simplicity, I'll just make a distinction between prevention and treatment. My colleagues in the public health fraternity and sorority would like to split it into primary prevention and secondary prevention and tertiary prevention, up to a point that anything that you do to prevent death is prevention. I agree with that. But for the purpose of our discussion this morning, let's just take prevention and treatment. Again, recent evidence from the U.S., in fact, suggests that between 1984 and the end of the last century, the incidence of cardiovascular disease actually remained constant. However, the post-event illness and disability declined, and that's telling us something. It's pointing to the place of treatment in reducing disability and in reducing morbidity after there is a cardiovascular event. Okay? What does this suggest? Before we can reach any conclusion, we need to look at the distribution of risk factors in these low-income countries and middle-income countries. In fact, in many of the low-income countries, and depending on which particular risk factor we're talking about, the prevalence of these risk factors is lower than it is in the high-income countries. Again, depending on which particular risk factor we're looking at. Which suggests to us, therefore, that the challenge facing the low-income countries is not that of catching up with the high-income countries. It's actually that of staying ahead of the high-income countries. And that's critical. Now, if you press this further, it suggests, therefore, that as incomes rise, people become wealthier, countries become wealthier, and they become exposed to more of these risk factors, either because they have unhealthy diet or because they are also exposed to advertising from cigarettes and they smoke more, for example, just to take a couple. Effective prevention is very likely to slow down the rate of increase of non-communicable diseases. But on current trends and given current technologies, we really are not confident to say that it will reverse those trends. And there's a fundamental distinction between slowing down the trend and reversing it. So what does this mean for public policy, or what might it mean for public policy? It's a dual message for the low-income countries and the middle-income countries. The first part of the message is be as proactive and aggressive as possible on prevention. And Rachel already walked us through some of the high-impact interventions, so I will not repeat those this morning. The other part of this message is prepare for the burden that is sure to come. Because as populations age, as communicable diseases are brought under control, as fertility is reduced, then we're likely to see in these same countries an increase in the burden of non-communicable diseases. We can slow it down through effective public policy and aggressive prevention, but we cannot, it's very unlikely that we can reverse the trend. So the twin message, if you like, to policymakers will be prepare and at the same time get ready. What then makes things a little more complicated, particularly on the get ready front? Now, what do I mean by this? Just a quick poll. How many people listened to the National Public Radio this morning when you were driving in? Yeah, I don't know if you heard the broadcast on the Democratic Republic of Congo and health. You caught it. Thanks. Excuse me. Well, I think it's a very nice entry into some comment that I would like to make in reference to what Rachel has already laid out. And that's the limit of cost effectiveness in this kind of settings, particularly for those interventions that take place in a clinical setting. See, for tobacco taxes, for example, that's of enormous benefit along the lines that Richard has already told us. However, the moment we start talking about the cost effectiveness of interventions that are delivered in a clinical setting, then in fact certain constraints come in with which policymakers have to deal, and that is the constraint of service delivery. In the end, what really matters is community effectiveness. It's how an intervention works in practice depends on a combination of factors such as the following. Are there trained health workers in the right quantity and quality, of the right quantity and quality to start with? Is there water supply in that health facility? Is the road good enough that people can even get to those health facilities? Will the workers be there? Will the drugs still be potent when they get to those facilities? Will the blood pressure cuff actually work, or has it broken down and it has not been replaced? And will the providers comply with the guidelines for good quality? Will the patient comply with the guideline for effective uptake of those treatments? So the point I'm trying to make is that cost effectiveness is a very powerful tool. It is not enough. It's one of the inputs into is one of those factors that will lead to success as policymakers decide where to allocate resources, and having allocated those resources, we'll get into issue of service delivery, effective service delivery, particularly in poor settings. So if I back up a bit and think through what the challenges are likely to be for us collectively over the next several years, I say they depend on what dimension of the problem we're talking about. Are we talking about improving the evidence base for decision making in low and middle income countries? If so, then we're talking about the responsibilities of local research institutions working in collaboration with their external counterparts. Are we talking about the extent to which that evidence actually informs public policy? If so, then we're talking about the extent to which the intellectual elite in each country, and I'm using the phrase intellectual elite in the descriptive sense, not in any pejorative sense now, the extent to which the intellectual elite in each country has an input into policy making in that country and the transactions and bargaining that go on among and within different interest groups within that country. Otherwise, it's very possible for additional public expenditure to be captured in tertiary hospitals in capital cities that benefit people like those who are sitting in this room today. And they do not get to the poor, they do not get to the urban poor, they don't get to the rural areas, for example. So that's one element. Now, if we're talking about public policies in the realm of taxation, for example, let's take up the tobacco tax example that Richard laid out. Then we're talking about the political economy in a particular country. There is an extraordinary convention, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the first of its kind, which is very powerful potentially, onto which some 133 or so countries have signed, if I remember the number correctly. But the next frontier is how to implement that at the country level. So the declaration in the convention is fabulous, but when we go to each country, then it comes to a power play among different interest groups within each society and also interest groups outside that society because they have to reckon with the effect of big tobacco, for example. There's a certain country that shall remain unnamed, which I was traveling some months ago. I saw this brand new elegant factory built by British American Tobacco, and they're churning out tobacco in the millions. And I also see a billboard advert by the same company that claimed that the citizens of that country knew a good thing when they saw it, and that good thing was tobacco from BAT. Okay. So on the one hand, we have the Framework Convention, which is a very useful tool. But on the other hand, we have this interplay of forces within each country that might prevent the best laid ideas or the best concepts from being realized. And that's going to be a collective challenge for us. So I think I'll rest there to allow adequate time for discussion. Thank you.
Soji, thank you very much. Well, I'd like to open things up to you. But before I do, I have a general question that I'd like to ask both our speakers. In terms of establishing priorities for all the issues that you've raised here, the modalities of treatment, the institutions, the changing nature of the rubric that we call chronic disease, what would be at the top of your list of priorities now? You've already mentioned, Rachel, a number of treatment steps that have had a large rate of return, so to speak. But from an institutional standpoint, what can and should be done to get a maximum effect as we look forward?
I should go first. I'm gonna answer this like a true research geek. I think it's very important that we get better data on this. And I know that that's probably not the really sexy answer. The sexy answer is that there's some policy things we can do right away. And I think that that's true. But it's very important that we establish some data collection systems that give us the ability to then choose interventions and make policy without making mistakes and without creating antagonism and enemies where it might not be necessary. Because it's important that if we act on this, and we should, that we act effectively. Otherwise, I think all the efforts are for naught. So though that's not very exciting, I would say that'd be at the top of my list, and there are other priorities that closely follow.
Thank you. Soju, would you like to?
Yes, I'll start off by agreeing with Rachel. I always agree with Rachel.
I'm honored.
Excuse me. In addition to that, I think probably if you really press me to identify the single most important thing that we can do, I think it's to work with the policymakers and opinion leaders in each country to recognize and own that problem in their own context. Absent that, we are really not likely to make much of an impact. Now, we may be able to achieve some things with little pilot projects in one district or so, but in terms of working with a country of 60 million people, 20 million people, it's vital that the decision makers in each country own the problem and therefore own the solution to it. While we work very hard to improve the data collection systems, the analytical methods, the evidence base that will inform those policies, I think there's a fair bit of evidence already that suggests some things that can be done. One of them is increased attention to tobacco control, for example, along the lines that, that Rachel pointed out. With the caveat that there are many forces at play within a particular country that might prevent that from being realized either as well or as rapidly as one might wish. Another thing that can be done is to work with civil society groups in each country to pay more attention to this dimension of health. Chronic non-communicable diseases are not as dramatic as communicable diseases, or some communicable diseases, let me put it that way. Therefore, they are not headline grabbers. And as a result, they tend to get lost in the daily course of events. And perhaps there's a certain degree of fatalism there that, well, you know, we're all going to die of something anyway. So, you know, Uncle David or my aunt Jessica died of XYZ, and perhaps that's the way it's going to be. That's a barrier that needs to be overcome. So, to summarize, I'll say a combination of two things. Absolutely, better information, or actually three things. Better information, working with our counterparts within the countries to own the problem and own the solution. And third, partnering with civil society, local research groups, etc., to bring this to the fore of local debate.
Thank you. Let's open things up to this audience. I know there are a number of specialists here, no doubt, who have observations or comments. I'd ask two things. First, would you wait for the microphone to reach you? And second, would you please identify yourself before you make a comment or ask a question? Who would like to begin? In the back, please.
I'm Jean McDermott from the Fogarty International Center at NIH, and I want to, first of all, say thank you for the speakers for a very cogent, comprehensive view at this thing, and I think it was very useful. I worry, though, about the world's ability to deal with chronic disease when some of the issues that the second speaker talked about in terms of the ability to really deal with these chronic disease issues. I mean, one of the reasons we haven't been able to deal with some of the infectious disease issues and the issues around the poorest of the poor is the ability to get the healthcare systems to work, to mobilize communities. And so I very much appreciate the fact that I think we've in the past focused on interventions for specific diseases without really looking at the infrastructure that's needed to actually implement those interventions effectively. And so I think that we're going to run across the same problem as we try to address chronic diseases.
Thank you. Would either of you or both of you like to respond to that?
Probably both of us. Do you want to go first for a change? So, too.
I think that's a very useful contribution. My suggestion would be that we look at this in combination and not as an either-or proposition. I think that many countries, their reality is such that they just do not have the luxury of waiting for the day when they will have the perfect health system to tackle all these problems. I think these are things that need to be tackled concurrently. That's a first take. A second one is that interventions actually make different degrees of demands on health systems. Some interventions are very system demanding or system hungry, if you allow the expression. But nobody needs a strong health system for a tobacco tax. We simply do not need that. Third, in many of these societies, the fact remains that if we look at excess deaths, not absolute numbers now, particularly in the low-income countries, if we look at excess deaths, actually communicable diseases account for the majority of excess deaths. Now, the trend is changing. I mean, the trend is towards non-communicable diseases. But as of today, if we look at excess deaths in these countries over what we see in the high-income countries, it's still communicable diseases. That said, I don't think it's an either-or proposition for several reasons. In a low-income country that is ravaged by tuberculosis and ravaged by malaria and ravaged by HIV/AIDS, for example, if they wait until the day when they have the perfect health system, well, they will have lost a lot of their health workers to AIDS to start with. Okay. At the same time, we must face the reality that unless we switch into the mentality of gradual development of a very strong health system, whatever short-term gains we make against these very prominent communicable diseases will not be sustainable or are unlikely to be sustainable for various reasons. Either domestic financing will not be sufficient to carry that burden over the long run, and nobody can be reassured that external financing is always going to be there in a large quantity. We all know how volatile development assistance can be. Or because the health workers simply are not there in the numbers that are required, or because the overall infrastructure within the country, including and beyond the healthcare delivery system itself, cannot sustain the services. So it comes down to a pragmatic balance in each context. I don't think there is any ready formula that will be applicable across all countries all the time. That would be my take on it.
Thank you. Rachel.
Very quickly, I agree with Soji, everything that he has said, and I would add a specific example of being able to simultaneously address communicable and non-communicable diseases, or it's not exactly that, but to be able to take what is already there and then bring in some improvements that will address some of the chronic diseases that we are talking about, and that's in the nutrition world, so it really isn't a communicable example. There's a tremendous amount of resources and infrastructure going in to address undernutrition, the poorest of the poor, and in many of the countries where we are most concerned about the communicable diseases, undernutrition is a concomitant problem with those communicable diseases. We could integrate the issues of overnutrition into those interventions. It hasn't been done. The nutrition world, who's been focused on undernutrition, doesn't even want to think about overnutrition. But what we really need to think about in this country and in poor countries is the whole life cycle that people experience in terms of their nutritional needs and in terms of the risks of poor nutrition. And so I believe, though it hasn't been proven, I do think we need to look at the possibility of addressing them not as an either-or, but in combination. And so we look at what we are already trying to do, and we say, how do we bring in the aspects that are contributing to this chronic disease problem? I had another point that I've forgotten, so.
All right, well, let us know if you remember. Another one in the back, please.
Yes, I'm Ken Bridboard, also with the Fogarty International Center. Again, to extend my personal congratulations to our panelists, and also acknowledge, of course, that Rachel worked with us for a number of years. So we're very grateful for that. A couple of points. One, a project that Rachel is playing a very prominent role on, this disease control priorities project, where the Population Reference Bureau is leading the effort to disseminate the results of that analysis, sponsored by, funded by the Gates Foundation, Fogarty, supported by the World Bank and WHO, among others. But Rachel, what's the web reference? Is it?
Thanks, Ken. It's www.dcp2.org, and it has a tremendous amount of information about diseases, including chronic diseases, available on the web.
Okay, so that's one point. Second point, I would say that the Fogarty Center and others at the NIH are increasingly aware of the need to do more to address chronic non-communicable diseases in low and middle income countries. But I would all, and that even goes as far as to say, and this was even within the last week or so, discussions as we make more and more progress on rolling out antiretroviral drugs in low and middle income countries to help people actually in effect convert their infection to a chronic disease situation, that there's more and more concern about the need to address the more common chronic diseases in those populations, even if those diseases and also so that's something that's receiving attention. The last point that I would like to make is that we often draw, you know, barriers in our minds between one category and the other, and in fact that there are quite a number of examples where communicable diseases can lead to chronic conditions. And those include, among others, hepatitis B, HPV, and also to remind people about the streptococcal infections and rheumatic fever, which are hardly a problem today in the U.S., but around the world are a major problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to make a response?
Yes. Forgotten. We were talking about whether we should wait or respond now, whether we should continue to focus on communicable diseases. A lot of these chronic diseases are driven by habits. The risk factors, the lack of exercise, the dietary habits. Once those things are in place, it's much harder to change them. And in a lot of the countries we're talking about, they're not in place yet. They're emerging. They're being brought to people by a variety of forces. But it's possible to roll a lot of that back if we take strong action sooner. Much more possible than changing it later, in my view.
We have three questions. Why don't we start, and we'll just move across.
Trevor Gunn from Medtronic. Morning. Thank you both very much. Very inspiring points of view. I'd like to ask two very basic questions, though. And actually, you hit it right on the head, Rachel, which is, and I guess it's my question of what is the good work happening out there in the community on this particular question rather than what you necessarily think about the question, which is the whole division between preventable diseases that are preventable and largely congenital diseases, which are clearly not preventable, unfortunately tend to be quite expensive to rectify, you know, a variety of different cardiac conditions with children born with open heart, those type of conditions. So the division between truly preventable and those that are not preventable by any habitual variations. And then the second question, actually, and I appreciate the commentary of both, the question of, sort of following along the same track that you were mentioning, that it's not a rich person's disease. It's the whole trend is not a rich person's phenomenon. It's a poor person's. I think a lot of people associate many diseases with being a men's problem, not a women's problem. And we know that more people die of sudden cardiac arrest in the United States now that are women more than men. So the question is that, which is, what is the best thinking about that? What is your opinion about that when it goes into other disease states? And what is going on elsewhere in the world that we ought to be looking out for specific to that?
Who would like to begin? Go ahead, Rachel.
Okay. I wanted to address the first question first, but I've forgotten it.
What is the best thinking preventable today relative to making that division? And I guess our colleague from Fogarty was just mentioning the issue of how we think in dualities, right?
Yeah. I don't have the statistics at hand about the percentage of congenital or non-preventable diseases that affect different populations, so I can't address the specifics of your question. But I'd say that most of the diseases we've been talking about today are considered by experts to be preventable. As we've talked about, most of them are driven by risk factors that to some extent involve people's making choice. And though there is a debate about how much of obesity is genetically related, for instance, and there's certainly some, there's no doubt about that, what we see happening, as I mentioned, in developing countries, happening very quickly is the onset of these diseases driven by some of these risk factors very quickly. That's not genetic. You don't change genes that quickly. So I think we could make a big dent in this problem addressing the prevention side. And the congenital side or the genetic aspect of it, that will require probably better treatments and accessible treatments in these countries, which is further off. So do you want to address number two? Or?
Very briefly, I'll actually start with number one as well. I think in terms of the congenital diseases, a lot of it depends on the context and the availability of services. If we're talking about a low-income country where only a small fraction of the women, of the pregnant women, have access to prenatal care, then by definition, the chances of detecting any congenital problem is very slim. So you're left with what happens postpartum. Okay. And the only way that is going to change is with increasing incomes and improvement in health services. That's the only thing that's going to resolve that. In terms of gender differences, it will have to be context specific and look at the numbers, and that takes us back to the issue of this sometimes false dichotomy. It's not always a false dichotomy, because at the end of the day, the service provider sees a human being, doesn't see a disease, and this person might have both hypertension and cervical cancer, for example, and cervical cancer just have an infectious origin to start with. So the point I'm trying to make is the following. In terms of public policy, I think it's probably more useful to look at the distribution in a population, given local data, and also to look at the trends within that particular society, and then identify which of the risk factors are amenable to intervention by government. Many are amenable to intervention by government in a way that can be very highly effective, others less so. Tobacco taxes, for example, taxes on alcohol, for example, that's another one. But the moment we start getting into interventions that affect, that have a quote unquote, what may be perceived as socially contentious debate about sexuality and exposure to certain risk factors, antecedent to cervical cancer, then things get a lot complicated depending on the society in which you are, because then people might begin to invoke their own moral perceptions, which may or may not fly with other people. But you'll agree with me that that's outside the scope of this discussion.
But we had a question in the. Yes. Please.
My name is Laura Blinkhorn with Congressional Quarterly, and I was wondering what steps are being taken now by the World Bank, the WHO, USAID, and other organizations to combat chronic disease, and in the future, do you envision a sort of global campaign similar to one for infectious diseases like HIV/AIDS?
Well, your question is in two parts, as I understand it. What steps are currently being taken? And second, do we envisage, quote-unquote, a global campaign along the lines of what is being seen for HIV/AIDS and TB? Let me take the second one first, because that's probably the simpler one. I cannot predict what this is going to be. Okay, but I can share with you my own perspective on this. I think that given the origins of these chronic non-communicable diseases that we've been talking about, and given the fact that they require multiple and often sustained contact with the healthcare delivery system, the way to address them is by switching into the mindset of a marathon, not a sprint. It's going to be a long, drawn-out, grinding process. And for initially, very aggressive prevention efforts. In the medium to long term, improvement in service delivery as this demographic wave hits us. I think that's the way to, that's my view on the way to go about this. Now, on to your first question. I can just share with you some of the work that the World Bank is assisting countries to do, and I think this is a fundamental issue to make. Countries implement programs in many instances with support from with financing from the World Bank. The World Bank does not implement programs in countries. That's critical. So in several countries, the bank is supporting analytical work, and in several countries, it's financing programs to control non-communicable diseases. So if you look at experiences in China, for example, the bank has been involved there. In Brazil, for example, the bank is very active in the surveillance program there. And also we are supporting a very strong look at tobacco control policies in Brazil. As I speak with you, that's ongoing. The bank, as you know, led the publication of a landmark book called Curbing the Epidemic on Tobacco Control several years ago, which was an enormous contribution, working with several other partners. Some years ago, we worked with the government of Russia and the World Health Organization on a series of public health policy seminars, as we call them, to look at the problem of chronic non-communicable diseases in the Russian Federation. And the government has decided that it's going to have what it calls an adult health program to tackle the issue. Which brings me back to one of the points that we discussed earlier, that perhaps one of the biggest contributions that international organizations can make is to work with the countries to recognize and own the problems as a foundation for then owning the solution and implementing that solution within their own country. I will urge caution in presupposing that international organizations can go in and fix the problem of chronic non-communicable diseases in the countries. I think it's starting off on the wrong foot, and I think that the right approach, in my view, is to assist the countries to recognize the problem, own the problem, and then own the solution to those problems.
I'll briefly add a little bit to what Soji said. In terms of what's happening now, I'd characterize it as non-existent to fragmented, depending on what organization and area of the world you're talking about. At AID, it's virtually non-existent, though there's some talk about looking at these issues. At WHO, of course, I mentioned earlier the global strategy that they developed, and it was approved by the World Health Assembly in 2002, and it's being implemented to varying degrees at country and regional level, but it certainly has helped raise awareness. And in terms of your second question, I would say an important way to consider what could happen in the future is that this isn't just a health sector problem and that isn't going to be solved just by the health sector. This is a problem also for agriculture. This is a problem for transportation systems. This is a problem for planning agencies and probably, above all, for finance ministries, though they may be the last to become aware of it.
Run over, but I think we have time for one last question, please, and sir, it is yours.
Thank you. I'm Michael Rosenthal. I'm detailed from Department of State to the National Institute now. Just one response to this question. There is one international program being managed by the International Atomic Energy Agency together with the World Health Organization, American Cancer Society, International Union Against Cancer, called Program of Action for Cancer Therapy, which was started in 2004 at the same time that the World Health Assembly took up for the first time a resolution on cancer prevention and control. And it's, you can look it up on the IAEA website, but it is an ongoing activity to help build cancer capacity in developing countries. It reminded me of a point that Dr. Adeyi made as well, which is the emphasis on the combination of prevention and addressing the burden or treatment at the same time. And this is strictly anecdotal evidence, but IAEA has long-standing programs in introducing, from their perspective, radiation therapy services in developing countries. About 55 or 60% of all patients on average that get cancer need or ought to get radiation treatment. And so it's one of the important aspects of cancer care. And the observation I would make, or the anecdotal evidence, is that introducing something on the treatment side actually serves as a catalyst, creates an environment, creates a constituency which helps advance the prevention side. So there's a community of people who are dealing with, in this case, cancer, who even if it's cancer treatment, are now part of a program to or a community and helping build community-based organizations that can tip the balance in how societies think about prevention and what they do about it. And a question, I noticed in the observation, Dr. Nugent talked about dailies, and Dr. Adeyi spoke about the burden on households and the burden on the economy of chronic diseases. Those are two ways of looking at impacts. And in the case of chronic disease, it strikes me that there's a real paucity of information about the economic impact and about the impacts that relate to household disruptions and women's issues and so on, particularly in the cancer area. Cervix cancer rates and risk factors are much higher in developing countries than in developed countries. I wondered, in terms of your research agenda, what's happening on the last point, how in measuring what's going on in terms of factors other than just dailies. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll mention direct response. We have a paper in production right now. The lead author is Mark Cirka at WHO, and I'm a co-author, that is on the economic impacts of chronic disease, and it tries to address with the available data the efficiency effects, the household effects, the effects on labor productivity, et cetera, trying to look at the question of, and a little bit on macroeconomics, but there's not much that we can say about that yet, I would say. But trying to put into an economic context the loss that individuals, households, and countries even will experience as this problem continues.
When will that paper be available?
In fact, the editors are done, and it's in production, and I think it'll be available in a few weeks, certainly in November, for sure.
Good. Thank you. Would you like to add anything?
Yeah, thanks. A couple of notes.
Yes, it is true that in low and middle-income countries, particularly in the low-income countries, the data are very patchy on the household impact of non-communicable diseases. We do have some data out there, and the work we're doing, we're collaborating with the lead author, Max Rucker, to whom Rachel referred, where we noted some of these existing findings, and we bring in some new perspectives from South Asia and East Asia as well, particularly India and Indonesia. But just to reel off some numbers, there are some data looking at the estimating the cost of some of these risk factors. For example, tobacco-related disease costs in China accounted for about 1.5% of GDP back in 1995. And in most developed countries, the total cost of cardiovascular diseases is estimated at somewhere between 1 and 3% of GDP. And we have similar estimates for diabetes, with the caveat that this tends to be very, very patchy, so I'd like to stress that. Now, back to your first question or your first observation on the prospect for improving prevention through treatment. I think that's intuitively appealing, and I want to start off my response to that by saying, yes, if it's one person that can be treated, I think that's good. It's good for that person, and it's good for that family. If you're looking at it in terms of public policy, though, it becomes more nuanced. We do have evidence to show that even for the delivery of services for non-communicable diseases, most low-income countries tend to serve better those who are already well off, i.e. the middle and upper-income quintiles. Which seems to suggest that all other things being equal, any massive effort on non-communicable diseases, which are very demanding of clinical services, are likely to perpetuate, if not worsen, the fact that services are already skewed in favor of the rich in those societies. And I think we need to recognize that up front. So it is not necessarily true that introducing a treatment program in a middle income set, I'm sorry, introducing a treatment program to which the middle to upper income quintiles will have access, will necessarily help those in the lowest quintiles to engage in prevention. The evidence simply is not there. I think it's more of a wish than evidence-based approach, quite frankly. But as I said, if it's one person that gets treated, I think it's good for that person, it's good for that family. It's just, if you're sitting in the chair of the policymaker and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Agriculture, then they have to think about the distribution of benefits that come from a particular public policy. They need to think carefully about the distribution of benefits that come from public expenditures and be sure that it matches the goals of their society. So if the intention is to increase the access that the poor have to preventive services, if the intention is to increase the access that the poor have to treatment services, then I'm not sure that we have found the formula yet in most low-income countries. And I'm not sure that introducing radiotherapy in a way that is likely to be captured by the elite of a society is necessarily going to improve prevention among the very poor in that society. We simply do not have the empirical evidence to back that proposition. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I'm afraid that that brings us to the end. I'm sorry, I know that there are questions on the table, but I'm afraid that brings us to the end of this forum. I think that many here would agree with me when I say that I wish we could continue for a couple more hours, that there are so many important issues that we've already taken on and we could continue to take on. Before I close, let me acknowledge gratefully Rachel Posner, who's done work on research and writing from the Strategy Institute on this whole issue. Thank you, Rachel. Catherine Mason in the back behind the camera is responsible for having organized today's event. She worked very hard on this. Thank you so much. And Laura Keating as well, who's done backup, including magnificent management of the microphone during our Q&A. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking both our speakers for what's been a remarkable session.